This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Material is selected with the interests of its audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Welcome to Backyard Bookshelf, a production of Audio Journal, bringing you fiction, nonfiction, and other readings with a local connection. I'm Naomi, and today I will be reading from A Place for Us by Nicholas Gage. We are resuming chapter 17. No, just cold water, I said with sudden longing. But I wanted it from Metsala, and I want to get it myself. I went through the courtyard out to the huge wooden gate, and with the massive handles clamped and the teeth of iron lions' heads, as I had done 1,000 times before. I knelt where the icy water bubbled out of a cleft in the rock, raised my cupped hands to my mouth, and suddenly I was a boy again. As I swallowed the water, I was transported back to a moment during the war when I was drinking at the same spot and a mortar shell struck a few hundred yards up the mountain, showering me with stones and debris. I could hear my mother screaming from the doorway of the house, certain I had been killed. The sound of a footstep behind me made me jump. I turned around to see Andreas, silently following me as he had in the old days. I stood up and tucked into his pocket the secret cache of money I had for him, knowing he would use it to buy bottles of Reiki at the coffee house to drink during the long days he sat high up in the mountainside, watching the sheep. He smiled and said with a conspiratorial wink, "You were always a devil." Later, when I discreetly handed my grandmother her secret money from my sisters, she turned it over to my grandfather as soon as he appeared, having lost the little guile she once had. It made me sad to think that she no longer would have hidden trove of ground coffee, her one luxury to enjoy when her miserly husband was out of the house. After I went back inside, Nitsa insisted that we all lie down for a siesta. Her own had been interrupted, and she was getting sleepy. "I'm not tired. I want to go up to the Piravoli and look at my house," I replied. Immediately, Nitsa began squawking. "People will see you. It's the siesta hour, after all. Why would you want to go up there anyway? It's all in ruins." She made such a fuss, with Andreas and my grandfather chiming in, that I decided to wait. I lay on the new mattress until I could hear them all breathing evenly, my grandparents on their pallets in the other room. Then I tiptoed out into the afternoon sunshine, gently closing the door with its latch and wooden bolt. The footpath that climbed past the Hades Gate continued straight up toward our neighborhood after the interruption of the new road. I knew every inch of this path, even in the dark, because I had always climbed it barefoot. Above my grandparents' house, there was a rocky stretch where you had to place your feet just so, almost like climbing a ladder. In the spring and fall, it was carpeted with yellow crocuses and purple grape hyacinths, but now it was covered with wild chamomile and clouds of drowsy bees. A little higher, the path curved toward the right, past a hayshed where I first learned about sex while exploring during the siesta hours, when I came upon a newlywed couple snatching a private moment of love in the shed, away from the many relatives who slept in the same room of their house. The road jogged back toward the left, and soon, beneath the spires of the ancient cypress trees, I saw St. Demetrios, the neighborhood church where my mother had stopped to pray every day, and where her bones now lay in the ossuary. In the cool purple shade beneath the cypresses was a tiny graveyard, each plot neatly enclosed by an iron fence, and containing a corpse that would be unearthed and moved to the ossuary after 3 years so that a new body could take up residence. The reddish clay tiles of the church's roof peaked above a niche that held the ancient icon of St. Demetrios slaying a foe, the painted colors as vivid as they had been hundreds of years before. I tried the door of the church, but found it locked. There was a padlock as well on the metal door of the square ossuary, and I saw no sign of a caretaker who might have the key, so I continued up the path toward my house. The next curve in the road brought me to the yard of the Makos property, the spot where I said goodbye to my mother before she descended into the ravine behind a file of village women being led by the guerrillas to work in the threshing fields. As I had watched, she had disappeared into the vegetation of the valley far below, then reappeared, a tiny dot, climbing the distant mountainside toward the chapel of the prophet Elias, where the road wound out of sight. That had been a bright summer afternoon like this one. She had turned around, a tiny brown and black figure, just before disappearing from my sight, and raised her hand to me in a gesture of farewell. Now the heaviness of the heat and the drone of the cicadas pressed like a weight on my shoulders as I squinted toward the distant mountainside, and it seemed as if I could still make out her figure on the path, her hand raised in that final salute. I turned my back to the ravine as the path took me again to the left and up toward our house. Our field was terraced into three levels below the house. As I approached the bottom level and looked up, I heard a scratching noise and saw a black shape moving among neat rows of beanstalks. At first, I thought it was a goat or a sheep, but then it straightened up into the figure of a woman, her black kerchief draped around her face, dusting her hands on her black homespun skirt. She looked straight into my eyes, with her blue eyes and my heart contracted. It was my mother waiting for me in our garden. Then she spoke, and my mother's features blurred, finally resolving themselves into the face of Evangelina Demetrio, a neighbor. "But who are you?" she cried, rubbing her hands on her apron. "Not the son of Eleni. They told me you were coming back. Your grandfather gave me permission to plant here, you know. It seemed such a shame to let the land lie fallow. Of course, no one would plant up by the house. They buried so many prisoners there. But I wanted to put in some rows of beans, tomatoes, and cucumbers. I hope you don't mind." "Of course not, Thea," I said, still trembling from the shock of seeing my mother waiting for me in our garden. "You plant anywhere you want. I just came up to look at the house." "What's there to see?" she asked, gesturing upward. "There's nothing left but the souls of the dead searching for peace. It's all changed, ruined, but go and look for yourself." I continued up the path toward the wall-enclosed compound and the gate, still intact but hanging ajar. Many flat stones had fallen from the top of the wall where I had sometimes lain as a child, sunning myself. Just inside the gate, I found a stone structure built by the soldiers, a sentry hut, perhaps, or a storehouse. The windows of our house were still barred, as they had always been, but the glass was gone. I went up to the front door, but it was locked and chained. So I just peered into the windows toward the kitchen, where we used to sleep in a row on the floor, and the main chimera, which had once held the iron bed reserved for my father's visits, the gramophone he brought, and the family iconostasis, where my mother's crossed herself every morning and evening. The empty kitchen brought quick image to my mind. My mother rhythmically churning the goat's milk to make butter, while I lurked nearby, waiting for the foamy whey to rise to the top, because I loved to eat it with bread. But now all was silent. There was nothing but dust and occasional swift movement of a lizard among the cracks in the stones. The kitchen wall built against the side of the mountain was damp and thick with moss. Discouraged because I had been expecting to see more, although I didn't know what, I walked downhill to the side where there was an entrance to the basement. This had been the quarters of the sheep and the goats dug into the slope of the mountain. It was a low-ceilinged cave-like room with tiny barred windows high up. And when the guerrillas had taken over our house as their headquarters, they had made the basement their prison. Here, in her own cellar, my mother had been kept, crowded in with dozens of other prisoners, until she was led with the rest of the condemned up to the ravine to her death. Here, she was taken from the prison to be interrogated and tortured in the rooms above and then thrown back, unable to stand. I had been told that at least one of the prisoners, a young woman from the village of Mavranoron, tried to kill herself to escape the horror of the basement prison, stabbing herself in the stomach with a large nail she found protruding from a beam. But she didn't die of the wound and was left to plead for water until she was taken out and shot. As I approached the entrance to the dark basement, I could see the wooden door was ajar. In the white hot afternoon sun, I felt claustrophobic fear of what was inside, but an equally strong force was pulling me into its depths. I couldn't stop walking toward the open door. "What are you doing here?" I spun around and saw it was Andreas, out of breath from hurrying up the mountain behind me. "Couldn't you wait?" he continued. "You had to come up here alone? Well, now you've seen it. Come back down with me. Your aunt and your grandmother are frantic." I turned away from the dark basement, secretly relieved that he had stopped me from going in. I matched my steps to his as we descended the path, past Vangelina Dimitrio, who paused in her hoeing to study my face intently. To hide my emotion, I asked Andreas about the houses we passed, which all seemed shuttered and empty. He told me of former neighbors who had gone to Germany or Athens in search of jobs, or who had never returned from Hungary or Romania after the war. When we got to the church of St. Demetrios, we stopped, and he said, "Wait here." Soon he returned with the keys to the ossuary. I had been inside it many times as a child when my mother had stopped to pray before the bones of her mother-in-law. Then the rows of skulls and crude boxes full of bones had held no terrors for me. But now my mother lay in that same room. Andreas unlocked the padlock, and the iron door swung noisily open. Right in front of me was a round with a small wooden box, not 3 feet long, standing on four legs, with a rounded light lid like a coffin surmounted by a simple metal cross. Behind it, on the wall, an icon of Christ, his body covered in hammered silver, raised his hand in blessing over the box, which my grandfather had fashioned to hold the remains of both my mother and his sister-in-law, Alexo, Fodo's wife. hand-lettered in white paint on the side of the box were the words, Eleni C. Goitianis, 41 years, and Alexandra F. Goitianis, 56 years, murdered 28 August 1948 by communist gangsters. There was a small ornate oil lamp hanging from the cross, but it wasn't burning. I came by here yesterday and lit the lamp, Andreas told me as he handed me a box of matches. But every time someone opens the door, the draft blows it out. He left me alone and went outside to smoke a cigarette among the graves beneath the cypresses. Inside the ossuary, I lit the wick of the oil lamp, but there in that dank, musty storehouse of the dead, I found it hard to believe that the small wooden box held any part of my mother. She seemed to be outside in the sunlight, pausing for a momentary prayer to St. Demetrios, then hurrying up toward our fields leading our donkey, Merjo, or down the path carrying fresh-baked pita to my grandmother. As I stared at the burning lamp, I wondered why all my memories were so rich and pleasant, when my childhood had been a decade of war and starvation. I realized that it was because my mother's love had wrapped me in an armor of security. Once she died, nothing ever seemed secure anymore, even our good life in Worcester. The great fissure in my life that opened when we were separated for that last time, me fleeing towards freedom, and my mother being led toward her death, was a chasm that had grown until I wouldn't let myself become so attached to anyone or anything again, because I feared it would be suddenly taken away. When Andreas and I finally descended to my grandfather's house, Nitsa and Megli were waiting. Nitsa immediately launched into a diatribe. You couldn't wait, could you? You had to go up for yourself, she screeched. Why go looking for pain? It'll find you soon enough. Wherever you go in this village, you should have someone with you. You don't know what these people are capable of. All right, I'll go up again tomorrow, and this time I'll take you with me, I said, trying to shut her up. But Nitsa crossed her arms and shook her head stubbornly. You can't expect me to climb up to the Pirivoli anymore. It's too steep for me. I can barely make it over here on the flat road from my house. Well, then, we'll go as far as St. Demetrios and make sure the lamp is still lit, I said placatingly. Even St. Demetrios is too far, she complained. My climbing days are over, now that I suffer this constant torture in my hips. A suspicion took root in me. When was the last time you climbed up to the Pirivoli? I asked. Last Easter, when Olga Venizis came back from Athens, and I went up to welcome her, she answered. You mean you'll climb the mountain to visit strangers, but you won't go up there to light a candle for your own sister, I shouted. What's the point, Nitsa snapped. I send Andreas to light the lamp every day when he passes with the goats. What good will lighting a candle do anyway? I can't bring Eleni back by lighting a candle. Neither can you. I decided to drop the subject, but it upset me to realize that my aunt and uncle and my grandparents, my mother's death was long past, while to me it was still a fresh wound. They had learned to live with the fact of Eleni's murder and go on with their lives, while I felt that their fate was too perverse ever to be accepted. I had to explore it and confront every detail of her suffering and death before I could go on with my own life. It enraged me to see the way my relatives calmly chose to put it in the past. The news of my arrival had reached every corner of the village, and no sooner was the siesta hour over than other villagers began arriving to get a look at Eleni's son. Nitsa grudgingly brought out trays of the sweets I had brought, ungraciously snatching them from the guests before they could take more than one, while Andreas hurried about making coffee and pouring shot glasses of Reiki for each newcomer. "Where are the good pastries, the one wrapped in gold paper?" I asked as Nitsa placed a few hard candies on a dish. "You start serving those and we'll have every beggar in the village over here," she said with a sniff. Soon, the two rooms of my grandparents' house were filled to overflowing. Each time more arrivals knocked, earlier visitors were forced to leave. The old village women all remarked in wonder on my resemblance to my mother. They sat on the floor around me, and like storytellers recounting a myth or fairy tale, they told me of the last times they had seen her. I learned that on the day after our escape, my mother and Aunt Alexo were arrested in the threshing fields, brought back to the village, and imprisoned in the guerrilla headquarters. But after 8 days, they were released, with orders that they were to speak to no one, especially each other. They were allowed to wander about at liberty until a month later. The guerrillas came and arrested them again. After that came the trial and the executions. I gathered from what the women told me that the guerrilla leaders expected my mother and aunt to lead them to the other conspirators or to serve as bait for a rescue attempt by their relatives on the other side. But when this didn't work, they decided on more direct means of getting information about the escape plot. Each old woman who visited me that night had memories of my mother in her blue dress, wandering the mountainside like a lost soul, while everyone feared to speak to her. One neighbor saw her sitting in the doorway, weeping and holding the brown book bag filled with my small treasures I had left behind at the last moment. Another woman, one of our closest neighbors, told with shame how, when she saw Eleni ascending the path, carrying a sack of beans from our garden as a gift, she whispered to her to toss it over the wall into the courtyard. She didn't want to be seen taking anything from the hands of the Americana. One of the few people who had dared to speak to my mother during her brief period of freedom was Olga Venizis, a very tall woman who lived in the house just above ours in the Paravoli. "I went down to our field one day below the Hades house, and I saw your mother far below, carrying kindling on her back, coming up the path. She told me as the light from the fire played on the sharp, strong features beneath her black mantilli. When we were close enough to talk, Eleni said, 'Come by the house, Olga, but stick to the back gardens so no one will see you.' When I get here," she pulled me aside and kissed me. She said, "They watch me at night. Every morning I find a pile of cigarette butts outside the gate. But today I've been as far down as the monastery of St. Athanasiosis, and I saw no one. I could have just kept going and reached the other side." I asked her, "Why in God's name didn't you?" And she told me she couldn't leave with Glykeria still in the threshing fields because they'd still kill the girl. She was quiet, thinking. Then she said, "It's so hard, Olga. The other night I had a dream and saw my little Fotini, her hair all unbraided and knotted, and my Nikolaki, and he was calling for me." Then she started to cry and said, "Olga, bring me Demetria once so that I can hold him for a little. He looks so much like Nicola." The next day I did. I brought my son, and she held him and wept. She had such a weakness for you. Then, when August began and the fast for the Virgin, they came to the house and took her back into the prison. I questioned Olga about the trial of my mother and the six other villagers. She said she had been there the first day when the entire village was summoned to the central square to watch the people's justice in action. But the proceedings had been disrupted by mortar fire from the nationalist encampments in the distant foothills. The judges were forced to run for their lives, and they moved the trial far up the mountain to the Risi, a high plateau used for festivals where overhanging cliffs gave protection. But by then I was too frightened to go, Ogo told me, because the main judge, a man with a voice like death himself, told me, "Your name is written in red ink," and I thought that meant they would arrest me next. "But I need to know about the trials," I insisted. "Who spoke against my mother? What were the charges? Who were the judges?" "You should go ask Athena Karamopoulos about that," replied Olga. "She was there for the whole 3 days." "When you saw Mana at the beginning of the trial, did she look like they had hurt her?" I asked, barely able to finish the question because my mouth was so dry. Finding out what my mother had suffered before her execution was what I dreaded most in coming to Greece. In my memory, she was always beautiful, her golden braids hidden by her kerchief, her dress and apron immaculate, her face serene. I didn't want this image permanently destroyed by the revelation of beatings and torture, bruises, blood, screams of agony, and cries for mercy. I wanted to remember my mother as strong and perfect as she had been when I had seen her last, and I recoiled from the fear of learning some different terrible truth about her suffering. God knows I had imagined many horrors, but no witness had yet turned these nightmares into facts. Yet I had to learn all she had endured, because she had done it to save me. No, it wasn't until after the trial that they really started to beat your mother badly, chimed in Vesiki Petsis, a wrinkled old woman with an innocent round face who lived near my grandparents' home. I remember when they brought Eleni down the mountain on a mule and made her show them where she had hidden Olga's dowry. I didn't even recognize her at first. She was so badly beaten. "Hush, woman, leave it," interrupted Nitsa. "What's the good of going over it all over again? Why upset the child?" The old woman lapsed into silence. I didn't say anything, for I was horrified by what I'd heard already, and the heat in the overcrowded room was making me feel sick. But I resolved to go find Athena Karamopoulos and to talk to Vesaliki Petsis later, when I could question her without an audience. All that night, people came and went, gobbling the pastries I had brought and exclaiming over how I resembled my mother. Several old women took me aside as they prepared to leave and inquired with friendly concern if I had fulfilled my military obligations in the United States. I told them all the truth, that I had an educational deferment until I finished graduate school. When the last visitor was gone and my aunt Nitsa was sulking over the depleted stores of sweets, I asked her why there was such an interest in my military record. "The old hags know that if you haven't served your time in the American army, then the Greek army can conscript you while you're here," she said, pressing a forefinger to the side of her temple. "They're asking so that they can inform on you." With a shiver, I said, "But what would they get out of it? Would they be paid for the information?" "No," replied Nitsa, chuckling. "They just like the feeling of power it gives them. They may not even inform on you. They just like knowing they can. You've forgotten how people are here. They still resent us because we were the prosperous family. Your father and your grandfather. The guerrillas beat your mother because everyone said she had a hidden treasure of gold sovereigns. But what they dug up after they beat her into confessing was nothing but a pot full of rotted blankets and rugs. Olga's precious dowry. The water had seeped in until it was all moldy. But the guerrillas still spread it all out on the ground and called the villagers, shouting, "See what wealth the fascist traitor has hidden." And there it was, all rotting and green with mold. I felt exhausted from the evening's revelations, although I knew I had to keep asking questions if I was ever to discover how my mother died. and who was guilty of her murder. But I had already learned more than I could stand that night, and my dreams, when I finally slept, were full of faceless monsters and shapeless things covered with rot, all of them waiting for me in the basement of our ruined home. Chapter 18. Stalking the Past. On these mountains, memory burns. The next morning, my grandfather took me to the village coffee house on the central square near the giant plane tree. It was a small tavern run by a man named Yergios Venizis. Tables spilled into the square, and a spit stood nearby, ready to roast chickens and goats entrails for the plates of the Mezidakia, including tidbits of olives, cheese, and tomatoes served with the drinks. When we arrived, the tables were filled with village men, talking, drinking, playing cards, passing around the most recent newspaper, and waiting to see the son of Christos Goitsianis. At our appearance, the laughter and joking faded to a silence broken only by the clicking of multiple strings of worry beads. Pointing his walking stick with authority, my grandfather selected an empty table. In a gesture borrowed from my father, I summoned the proprietor and announced, "Treat the house." The bill that eventually arrived, scribbled on a scrap of brown paper, added up to less than a dollar. So I promptly ordered another round, determined to do my father's reputation proud. Soon we were joined by two leathery old men, eager to test our skill at the game of choice in Lia, Xiri. I looked around at the interested observers and again was astonished by how few faces I recognized. It bothered me that I didn't know which were friends and which were enemies, who had spoken against my mother, and who had taken pity on her. Like poker, Katsiri requires skill at bluffing and recalling which cards have been played. The stakes were no more than the price of the drinks we consumed during the game, but my grandfather's reputation as a card sharp was also at risk. As soon as I shuffled the cards with the waterfall effect my grandfather had taught me, I saw that our audience was impressed, and my grandfather began to preen. As partners, we soon discovered we had an uncanny ability to bluff in tandem and to lay traps for our opponents. After a few winning games of Kasiri against different pairs of men, it was clear that I had succeeded in burnishing my father's and grandfather's reputations. Setting down the deck, I called again to the owner, "Treat the house, Giorgio, and bring some more Mezidakia, in the name of Christos Gatianos." I looked at my grandfather, and Kitsos Haidis, I added, and he beamed. Although my grandfather was a relentless miser to his family, he was obsessed with putting on an impressive show of hospitality to outsiders. The feast he offered to those who came to pay their respects on his name day was legendary. Besides endless rounds of Ktsiri, the primary leisure entertainment for the men of the village was a display of competitive conversational wit. The itinerant tinkers, cobblers, and coopers of Wea spent long working journeys on the road for 6 months to a year at a time, going from house to house to solicit business, sleeping on the ground at night. When they returned, during their well-deserved period of rest and recreation, before setting out on another odyssey, they gathered daily in the coffee house to regale their compeers with tales of gossip overheard, women seduced, murders committed, family feuds begun, Olympian hardships and natural disasters endured. Stories that improved in the telling. In 1,000 coffee houses like this one under 1,000 plane trees throughout Greece, the tradition of Socrates and his symposium were kept alive. My grandfather was the acknowledged sage of Lia, and his cleverness coupled with his prestige as a millwright was the reason he had been continuously reelected to the post of the village president before the war. As I sat watching him in the caffeneon, I noticed that his technique was to listen while the others spoke, interjecting ironic comments now and then to indicate his amusement at the stupidity of the speaker. Then, when everyone had said his piece, he would stun the group with a verbal coup de spray. Many of his village cronies were so dull-witted, however, that they didn't realize that they were being ridiculed and decreased my father's enjoyment if he had no one there to appreciate his cleverness. This was my function. Politics, hunting, border disputes, feuds, sports, and of course sex. These were the traditional topics. On the first afternoon of my visit, the subject for debate was what it takes to achieve success with women. Several listeners pulled their rush-seated wooden chairs over to our table to contribute their opinions, while my grandfather listened with a look of amused disdain. "Money is what you need," averred a tinker in his 40s, his face and hands patterned with scars from stray bits of burning solder. "If you spend enough money on a woman, she's sure to give in. I remember this woman in Larissa." "Not the good women. They can't be bought," interrupted a cooper. "But any woman can be won with praise. Tell her how beautiful she is, if she's plain, or how intelligent she is if she's beautiful. Say she moves through the wheat field like the summer breezes. Women will believe anything. Pretty words, my friends, not drachmas, will storm the barricades of a woman's chastity. "All women aren't that vain and stupid," disagreed another man. "The whole secret is just to be persistent and make them feel needed. If a woman believes you need her, then you'll die without her. And if you keep returning to the fray, even though she begins by saying no, in the end, she'll say yes." Thus it went, with each man proposing his own theory about the secret of success with women. When they were all done, my grandfather leaned back in his chair, turned the full force of his frown on each man in turn, and announced, "You're all wrong. No wonder none of you could seduce a 20-drachma hooker in a Piraeus bar." "Then tell us, Barbakitsos," they chorused, "what is the true secret?" They asked eagerly, for everyone in the village knew that my grandfather had been a famous womanizer well into his 70s, and perhaps later, yet unlike other men, he had never been caught by an outraged husband or father. Rumors surrounded him like a seductive aura, but the women of the village kept their secrets, and so did my grandfather. More than once, however, my grandmother had gone after him with a fireplace poker on the basis of rumors that reached her ears. "The one quality you need to succeed with women, whether they be young or old, ugly or beautiful," my grandfather announced as we all leaned forward, "is the ability to recognize those who want it." He settled back in his chair, smiling in satisfaction, as the rest of the men sat stunned by the brilliance of this observation. That was, of course, what had made my grandfather such a successful philanderer over the years. He recognized the ones who wanted it. His mill lay in a ravine at the bottom of the village by a waterfall. The village women would harvest their wheat, load it in sacks on a mule, and carry it down to the mill to be ground into flour. My grandfather watched as they came, noticing which women allowed a hand to graze his as they unloaded the sacks together, which ones went over to the stream and splashed cold water on their faces, revealing a bit more throat than was necessary. "Why don't you come back later?" he'd say to such women. "I'm too busy right now, but I'll grind your wheat at noon when I'm finished with the rest." And when she returned to the deserted mill, he would grind more than her wheat. Village women in Lea and Barbori had husbands who were gone for a half a year or more at a time. So it was no wonder that many of his customers were attracted to my grandfather's muscular body, chiseled face, and intense blue eyes. Furthermore, he had that one essential for success. He could recognize the ones who wanted it. As I admired my grandfather's cleverness that day in the coffee house, I couldn't help contrasting him once again with my father, who was naive and innocent, easily duped by those around him. My father was impulsive in his anger, but quick to forgive, while my grandfather never got in a fist fight, but would nurse his anger for months, eventually taking his revenge. He had a habit of rendering judgment on villagers who had felt wronged him, casting himself as judge and jury. He might decide that the village doorkeepers had cheated him and announce with cold anger in front of the customers, "You overcharged me 2 drachmas for the sugar I bought yesterday. I went home and weighed it myself. Therefore, I will not buy anything from this store for the next 6 months." And he would carry out this sentence to the day. This well-known behavior guaranteed that my grandfather always got the sweetest and softest lukumi, the tenderest cuts of meat, and just a little extra sugar every time he made a purchase. After our triumphant first afternoon at the Cafenion, he and I returned to the Hades house and found Magali asleep. I decided to make feta and onion omelets for the two of us, and as I cooked, Grandfather watched me with satisfaction. "It's good to have your company," he said. "Most of the regulars at the Cafenion are soft in the head from too much sitting in the sun. Today it reminded me of the old years when your father was back on one of his visits, lording it over the coffee house like the Pasha of Yanina in his fine American clothes, buying everybody food and drink. Of course, we all had to listen to the same stories every day, how he takes weekly baths, how clean habits and regular hours made him a tycoon and community leader. There are 2 basic rules to living a long, healthy life," he would always say, like Moses passing out the commandments. "Never sleep on your left side, and have a bowel movement every morning." Grandfather laughed his hacking smoker's laugh. I always enjoyed Christo's company, even if he let the locals take advantage of him, he reminisced. "Why didn't he come back with you this time to play the plutocrat again?" His smug superiority annoyed me. As instructed, I repeated what my father had said, softening it a little because I feared arousing the full heat of his anger. "He doesn't want to come, Papu," I told him, "because he's never forgiven you for leaving Mana and us alone when the gorillas were coming without even saying goodbye." My grandfather's eyebrows drew together and his face darkened until I began to get nervous, but he didn't lash out. I knew he was remembering how he had stopped speaking to my mother at the end because he insisted that my father owed him 500 gold sovereigns for giving us enough leftover flour to avoid starving during the famine that followed the German occupation when the mails from America were cut off. He and my mother had been bitterly estranged when he fled the village ahead of the invading guerrillas, leaving us to our fate. "I fed you during the war, and I felt I was owed something," he said finally, "but I could tell he wanted to leave it there." "But you knew the guerrillas were coming. We were trapped when you left us behind," I pledged on. "They made us suffer and turned us out of our house and finally started taking the children. So Mana arranged our escape because you didn't, and they killed her for it." "Who knew any of that was going to happen?" he said. "We thought the guerrillas would stay a few days and leave. That's what they had done in other villages. When it became clear they were dug in to stay, I worked out a plan to sneak back and get you all out." "So why didn't you?" I snapped, in my own temper flaring. "Nobody came for us, ever." "You're wrong. I did come for you," he retorted. I came back with the Nationalist troops in March of 1948 when they attacked the Morgana. There were several of us from Leah and Baburi with them, hoping to get our families out. I got as far as Aggie's panties, and then I learned the shooting and realized that they would never make it into Leah. We were outnumbered and outfought. So I stayed in the Aggie's panties, but the others went on ahead and the soldiers and were captured, the fools. "While you stayed behind and saved your skin," I said acidly. "You'd rather I went ahead like those idiots and got captured," he shouted. "Look what happened to them. Spiros Magdalis, he was caught. They arrested his wife, too. And they lined them up in front of the church and shot them in front of their children. Is that what you wish I'd done?" "What did Magdalis accomplish? I tried to come back for you, but I'm not a fool. I knew when to retreat." I turned his omelet out onto the plate with an angry gesture, and we ate in silence. I knew he was right, as usual, and I couldn't help admiring his cunning, but part of me still wished that he had cared enough about us to risk his life, even though things might have ended as he said. Instead of conceding his guilt, he shouted and defended himself when I confronted him with my accusations. My father, far less culpable because he had been on the other side of the ocean when the guerrillas came, had reacted exactly the opposite. He had heaped all the blame on his own head. My grandfather was smarter, I mused, but I found it hard to like him. The coolness between us lasted for a few days, but eventually dissipated in our daily visits to the coffee house, our card triumphs, and our mutual enjoyment of my grandfather's bone moots. Eventually, a weary respect for each other replaced the bad feeling. He liked having me around, and I couldn't help taking pride in the way everyone looked up to him. One afternoon, when my grandparents were sleeping, I climbed up the path to the house of Athena Karamopoulos, who had attended all 3 days of the trial. She was a small woman with intelligent brown eyes who lived near the church of St. Demetrios and had been one of my mother's friends. "No, your mother didn't look like she'd been beaten when she came to the trial," Athena said in answer to a question. "They beat her later. At the trial, she just seemed sad and resigned. She thought from the beginning that they were just going to kill her. She told me that during the period between her first imprisonment and when they took her in again." I asked her who among the villagers had spoken against my mother, and she told me. A total of 21 witnesses had been called to repeat, in public, the testimony they had given in secret against the 7 defendants from the village. "Most of the witnesses against your mother didn't say much that was incriminating," Athena said. "They told how Eleni made her daughters wear kerchiefs to hide their faces from the guerrillas, and how she hid valuables from them. But the one who really hurt her was Melia Druboyanis, because her mother and sisters were the first two escape attempts, and she described it in details, how the group turned back once because of the baby's crying, and again because of heavy fog. She testified to save your mother, who was also on trial, but she didn't have to say that your mother organized everything. She could have put the blame on one of the people who escaped. Melia was wearing her guerrilla uniform at the trial, and she banged her rifle on the ground and shouted, 'I swear by the gun I am holding.'" "Where is Melia now?" I interrupted. Athena shook her head. "She's in Czechoslovakia, I think, where many of the hardcore communists ended up." "Did anyone speak up for my mother?" I asked. "The only ones who dared were the old people," she answered. "Old Gregory Tsavos said, 'I have known Eleni Gatsionis all her life, and I know she has done no injury to anyone in the village. On the contrary, she always shared whatever she had.' But the judge cut him off. Then Kostas Poulos stood up, and they thought Since Poulos was a communist and his son died fighting for them, he'd speak against her. But Poulos said the same thing. The judge got furious and finally said, only those with evidence should speak up. And so no one else did. Which judge? How many were there? I asked. There were three, I think. The main one, the one with a deep voice who was in charge. He was called Katsis, Athena replied. But Katsis just means judge in Albanian, I said. That's not a real name. I know, she answered. They all had fake names to disguise their true identity. Even the commander of the guerrilla army, the one who had his headquarters in Barbori and who told all the judges what to do. We all called him Pavlos Arvanitis, but later, when the guerrillas retreated behind the Iron Curtain, the man became the head of the entire Greek Communist Party in exile. That's what he is today. His real name turned out to be Kostas Kolianis. But the others, the judges, the jailers, the ones who beat her, how can I find them if I don't know their real names, I said. They must be on record in the army files somewhere, Athena suggested. You could probably find that out in Athens. Over the next few days, I talked to several other women who had been at the trial and asked them the same questions. Who were the jailers? Who were the officers? Who were the leaders? But they could only had nicknames like the butcher and descriptions. Several had good memories for the testimony at the trial, however, and I hoarded each bit of information like a piece of a mosaic that one day I would be able to lay out all the pieces and fit together the pattern of my mother's last months of life. One afternoon, I went to the house of Vasiliki Petsis, the old woman who had started to scribe the day the guerrillas brought my mother out of the prison to dig up Olga's dowry. After bustling about making me coffee and chatting about my sisters, the black-clad woman with the guileless face picked up the tale of her last sight of Eleni. At the trial, she looked as always, calm, resigned, dignified, her hair covered with a kerchief, she said. Then sometime after the trial, I was in my house when I saw a procession. Three guerrillas walking in front of the mule, one with a shovel, another with a pick. Then the mule with a woman riding it slumped against the back of the wooden saddle, her chin on her chest. Behind her were two pack horses and lots of guerrillas. All of the other neighbors were hiding behind their curtains and peeking out. But I was always too curious, and I came out of my yard and over to the Hydas gate, where they stopped. I heard her say, "It's there, under the patch of dry beans." But she spoke with an unnatural voice, as if it pained her to talk. And they left her and went to dig, thump, 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 with the picks. I went up close and I said, "Eleni, my child, is that you?" And slowly, slowly, she lifted her head and looked into my eyes and said something. I could hardly make it out. "Go," she said, "or they'll do the same to you." Her lips were cracked and her hair was uncovered and all knotted. Her legs and feet were bare and terribly swollen, all black from the beatings. By this time, I was on my feet, unable to hear another word. "That's enough. That will do," I snapped, startling the old woman, who was just getting into the spirit of her story. Clearly proud that she had been the only one brave enough to speak to my mother. "But don't you want to hear the rest?" she asked. "Not now. Another time," I muttered as I headed for the door. "Thank you for the coffee. But I have to get back. They'll be looking for me." I left the Petsis house far more discouraged than when I had left Athena Karamapoulos. The names of my mother's jailers and judges were eluding me, but I had hopes of finding them in Athens. But the sickening horror that filled me when I heard Mrs. Petsis so glibly describing my mother's pitiful condition was more than I could bear. I had cut her off because I couldn't stand to know any more, what she had already said would haunt me for years, and I realized I wasn't strong enough yet to learn any more of how my mother had suffered. Imagining the execution, the fatal shots that ended her life in a split second, was something I could endure, but to imagine her agony and her loneliness, cut off from everyone she loved, without any hope of deliverance, that was still too painful. I had purposely scheduled my visit to Leah to coincide with the 3-day festival celebrating the feast of the village's patron saint, the prophet Elias, because I knew that the far-flung villagers would return if they possibly could for the Panieri. It would be the perfect opportunity to question those who had been in Leah during the last weeks of my mother's life. For days before the festival began on July 20th, the bust from Filiades disgorged arriving Leotes returning to stay with relatives or in their deserted family homes. I had been born on the 3rd day of the festival in 1939. When my mother's labor began, she sent Olga up the mountain to bring the midwife and Aunt Alexo down from the festivities to assist at the birth. According to my sister's accounts, as mother labored in our house, pulling on a sash hung from the roof's beams, my grandfather lurked outside, puttering in the garden. He had already suffered the disaster of 4 granddaughters, and it was another girl he was prepared to hide his grief. But finally, the midwife sent Olga out to ask for her grandfather's hat. When one has great news, the tradition is to snatch the hat of the lucky recipient and make him redeem it with gold. The moment Olga said the word hat, her grandfather grabbed her in a gleeful bear hug, the only time anyone ever saw him show affection towards his grandchildren. After my birth, my family celebrated the arrival of a boy for 40 days, baking and serving hundreds of pastries as the villagers came to see the Americana's son, while the mirrors of our house were covered to keep out the evil eye. You have been listening to Backyard Bookshelf, a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Naomi. Thank you for listening.
Would you like to hear news from Auburn, Grafton, Millbury, and Sutton that you're not likely to hear on commercial television or radio? Then tune in to Audio Journal every Monday at 5 p.m. Audio Journal is supported in part by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. We are a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Would you like to hear news from Blackstone Valley and Webster that you're not likely to hear on commercial television or radio? Then tune into Audio Journal every Thursday at 5 p.m.